Welcome to your daily cybersecurity briefing deep dive. If you map out the history of network breaches, you really see this distinct evolution in how attackers actually gain initial access.
Right. The entry methods are always shifting.
Yeah, exactly. So stage one is basically manipulation, right? Mm-hmm. You know, tricking a user into unlocking the door from the inside. Then stage two is just brute force, like finding a structural vulnerability and literally kicking the front door off its hinges.
Which we still see constantly, unfortunately.
Yeah. But stage three is where the landscape becomes truly insidious. They don't even touch the door at all. They get a job at the brickyard and they poison the very materials your infrastructure is built from.
That progression captures the exact threat landscape we're analyzing today, actually. We are looking at three critical incidents that perfectly illustrate each of those stages.
It's a busy day.
It really is. I mean, we've got a mysterious zero-day in Microsoft Exchange that relies on user interaction, a maximum severity authentication bypass in Cisco Catalyst SD-WAN that just kicks the perimeter door down.
And then that crazy supply chain attack.
Yeah. A highly targeted supply chain attack hiding inside the core developer tools of the Node EPASC NPM package.
What really stands out when you look at these three incidents side by side isn't just the severity scores. You know, it's the sheer sophistication of the evasion techniques. Mm. Attackers are anticipating our standard enterprise defenses and just, well, actively engineering workarounds.
Staying one step ahead.
They really are.
Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with stage one, the manipulation tactic. So we have a new vulnerability in Microsoft Exchange server. It's tracked as CVE-2026-42897, and it carries a CVSS score of 8.1.
Right. And to establish the parameters of this vulnerability, it impacts on-premise Exchange server versions specifically.
Okay, so not the cloud versions.
Exactly. That covers Exchange 2016, 2019, and the subscription edition. And it applies to literally any current update level for those. But like you said, if your organization is operating exclusively on Exchange Online, Microsoft has confirmed you are entirely unaffected.
Oh, well, that's a relief for some. But for the folks managing the on-prem infrastructure, what's the actual attack vector here?
It's a spoofing bug, stemming from cross-site scripting, or XSS.
Okay, so when we talk about XSS in an email client context, a helpful way to visualize it is like a malicious stage direction hidden inside a theater script, right? The web browser is the actor reading the script.
That's a really good way to put it.
Thanks. So the attacker sends this specially crafted email. And the moment a user views that email in Outlook web access, the browser just reads that malicious stage direction.
Because Exchange failed to properly sanitize the input, yeah.
Right. So the browser just goes ahead and executes arbitrary JavaScript right in the context of that user's active session.
Exactly. The browser basically assumes the instruction is coming from the trusted webmail application itself. Because, you know, Outlook web access has to parse and render the contents of the email to display it visually.
Right. It has to show you the message.
Yeah, so any failure in input neutralization means the attacker's script runs with the exact same access privileges as the person reading the email.
Oh, wow. So if an IT administrator opens that email.
Yep. The script inherits their administrative permissions. It can then exfiltrate the inbox contents, modify forwarding rules to intercept future communications, or even use that session token to pivot into other integrated enterprise services.
Wait, really? But if this requires the user to actually open the email in OWA, couldn't a standard endpoint detection and response tool catch that? Like catch the abnormal execution behavior?
You would think so, but...
Like even if the initial payload slips through the spam filter, shouldn't the EDR flag a browser suddenly executing unauthorized commands?
Well, endpoint tools are excellent at catching post-exploitation activity, right?
Like yeah.
A browser attempting to spawn a command shell. But the initial execution here happens entirely within the memory space of a legitimate, trusted browser process.
Oh, I see. So it just looks normal to the system.
Yeah, the JavaScript is just interacting with the web page's document object model. That makes it incredibly difficult to detect at the point of origin without generating just an overwhelming number of false positives.
That makes sense.
And that actually brings up the most concerning aspect of Microsoft's advisory. They flagged this with an exploitation detected assessment, but they provided no indicators of compromise, no threat actor attribution, no target demographics.
Literally nothing. That is the ultimate diagnostic muddy water for a security team.
Mm.
I mean, you get an alert that an active zero day is being exploited in a ubiquitous platform like Exchange, but you're handed a blank sheet of paper regarding what to look for in your logs.
It's a worst case scenario.
You are essentially in a race against an invisible clock. You know someone is exploiting this, but you don't know their IP ranges, you don't know their payload signatures, their objectives, nothing.
Right, and it forces security operations centers to operate purely on defense rather than, you know, proactive threat hunting. Microsoft is currently developing a permanent patch, but the immediate response relies entirely on temporary mitigations via the Exchange Emergency Mitigation Service.
Okay, so how does that work?
By default, this service should automatically pull down and apply a URL rewrite configuration to the ICO web server that sits in front of Exchange. This rewrite intercepts the HTTP request and strips out the malicious rejects patterns before the vulnerable OWA component ever processes them.
Okay, but if you're managing air-gapped servers or, like, environments with strict egress controls where that automatic update fails to reach the outside internet, you're looking at a highly manual remediation process.
Exactly. You have to download the latest Exchange on-premises mitigation tool, the EOMT script, and run it manually via an elevated Exchange management shell.
And here is the practical takeaway where response teams are absolutely going to stumble. There is a cosmetic bug in the mitigation script itself.
Yes. Imagine running the emergency mitigation script during an incident response scramble, right? And the description field throws a glaring error stating, mitigation invalid for this Exchange version.
Oh man, if I'm an IT admin at 3 a.m. applying an emergency patch, seeing an invalid error is going to cause my blood pressure to spike.
The natural instinct for any engineer is to assume the system is still exposed or to immediately attempt to roll back the change, assuming the script just broke the server configuration.
But Microsoft explicitly noted in the documentation that this is purely a cosmetic display issue, right?
Yeah, they did. The critical indicator is the status column. If the status column next to that error explicitly says applied, the server is successfully protected by the URL rewrite rule.
So just ignore the text field.
Exactly. Response teams must trust the status column and ignore the text field. It's a vital operational detail that could honestly save organizations from hours of unnecessary rollback procedures and extended vulnerability exposure.
Okay, so that covers stage one, manipulating the user. But let's transition to a scenario where the attacker doesn't need a user to click anything at all. It's one thing to rely on a user making a mistake to get inside, but what happens when the network's own routing manager leaves the front door wide open?
Then you have a massive problem on your hands.
Seriously. And that's what we are seeing with our second story, CVE-2026-2182 and Cisco Catalyst SD-WAN. CISA just added this to their known exploited vulnerabilities catalog, mandating federal agencies patch by May 17th, 2026. And it is sitting at a CVSS 10.0, which is maximum severity.
Yeah, 10.0 is as bad as it gets. The Catalyst SD-WAN controller and manager, they basically function as the centralized brain of a wide area network.
Right.
They dictate the routing policies, they manage the cryptographic keys for VPN tunnels, and they control traffic flow across branch offices, remote workers, data centers, you name it.
And this vulnerability is an authentication bypass, right? Yeah.
Exactly. It grants an unauthenticated remote attacker full administrative privileges to that central brain. They do not need a username, they do not need a password, and they don't need to trick a user into interacting with any payload.
But if we're looking at a 10.0 on a critical perimeter device, I have to ask, shouldn't Cisco's default configurations have some kind of rate limiting or fail-safe to prevent an unauthenticated request from instantly granting root access?
Right.
Like, how is it structurally possible to bypass the authentication mechanism so easily?
Well, it typically comes down to a fundamental flaw in how the management API or the web interface handles session tokens prior to the actual authentication check.
So the check happens too late in the process?
Sort of, yeah. Mm-hmm. If the software fails to properly validate a specific malformed HTTP request, it can inadvertently parse the request in a way that tricks the backend database into granting access to the requested administrative endpoint.
Yeah.
And it does this without ever verifying the user's cryptographic identity.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and once that structural parsing flaw is discovered, rate limiting becomes totally irrelevant. An attacker only needs to send one perfectly crafted packet to succeed.
So what does this actually look like in the wild? The reporting indicates that high confidence attribution points to a sophisticated threat actor group designated as UAT861's years. And they aren't just exploiting this single flaw and calling it a day, right?
No, not at all. They are chaining this new authentication bypass with three older Cisco vulnerabilities, CVEs ending in 2133, 2128, and 2122.
To do what, exactly?
Well, UAT861 scene is utilizing that chain of vulnerabilities to establish incredibly deep persistent access that survives beyond a simple software patch.
Right, because patching the door doesn't kick them out of the house.
Exactly. After bypassing authentication with the 10.0 flaw, their post-compromise actions involve injecting their own SSH keys directly into the underlying operating system. They are modifying NetConf configurations.
Which is the protocol used to install network configurations, right?
Yes, allowing them to alter routing behavior or mirror traffic to capture sensitive data. And they are routing their command and control traffic through Operational Relay Box, or ORB, networks.
Oh yeah, for those who might not track adversary infrastructure setups, ORB networks are essentially proxy meshes made up of compromised edge devices, like small office routers or IoT devices.
Right, just random consumer gear mostly.
Yeah, and they use these meshes to launder their traffic, making it incredibly difficult for a defending SOC to block malicious IPs. Because the attack looks like it's coming from a random residential router rather than a known adversarial server.
It is a highly sophisticated infrastructure setup. However, the threat landscape for this vulnerability has shifted drastically. The sources highlight that public proof of concept code is now circulating in the wild.
Oh no, so it's not just the advanced groups anymore.
Not at all. Specifically, attackers are utilizing a Java Server Pages web shell called Zen Shell, which was developed by Zero Xanax Labs. And because of that public POC, we are no longer just dealing with advanced persistent threats like UAT-86.1C.
So what does this all mean for defenders? I mean, the reporting shows at least 10 distinct threat clusters have been actively exploiting this since March of 2026. 10 separate groups fighting over the exact same vulnerability.
What's fascinating here is the commoditization of the exploit. It triggers a total gold rush mentality.
Yeah.
When a critical flaw hits a ubiquitous perimeter device, the initial access brokers move in first, to harvest access to sell later.
Right, get the foothold, sell the keys.
Exactly. But once the POC is fully public, the ecosystem fragments immediately. You have Cluster 6, for instance, deploying the Sliver command and control framework.
Which is pretty serious.
Yeah, Sliver is a highly capable modular tool typically leveraged by sophisticated actors for quiet, long-term espionage or staging complex network-wide ransomware deployments.
But then, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, you have Clusters 7 and 9. And they aren't trying to be quiet at all. They are just dropping XSMRAID cryptocurrency miners.
Just making as much noise as possible.
Literally.
Yeah.
They are trading any pretense of stealth for immediate financial gain by burning the compromised network controller's CPU cycles to mine Monero.
It really highlights the chaotic free-for-all nature of public vulnerability exploitation. I mean, Cluster 10 is deploying specialized credential stealers, specifically targeting JSON web tokens, administrative hash dumps, and even AWS credentials stored on the vManage instances.
It's just a free-for-all.
It is. We are seeing threat actors deploy Godzilla web shells, behinder web shells, NIM-based backdoors like NIMplant. The practical reality is that multiple distinct criminal enterprises are actively scanning the internet and racing to compromise the exact same vulnerable IP addresses.
Wow. If you are running Cisco Catalyst SD-WAN in your environment, this isn't something you queue up for the next standard patching window. You have to beat that May 17th federal deadline, but frankly, you need to remediate today. The sharks are already in the water, and they have 10 different types of payloads ready to deploy.
Yeah, you cannot wait on this one. So we have examined manipulating users in Exchange and exploiting structural parsing flaws in Cisco perimeter devices. But the third incident represents the most insidious approach.
The inside job.
Exactly. It bypasses the network perimeter entirely by poisoning the underlying materials used to build the software itself.
Right. We are talking about a severe supply chain attack hidden inside a highly popular NPM package called Node-EPIG. This is a tool utilized by countless developers to facilitate inter-process communication in Node.js applications.
It's everywhere.
Yeah, and researchers found malicious, obfuscated backdoor and credential-stealing behavior hidden inside versions 9.1.6, 9.2.3, and 12.0.1.
Context is absolutely crucial for understanding the trust dynamics here. This specific package has a highly publicized history. Back in 2022, the original maintainer, an account operating under the name Reevangelist, deliberately introduced destructive code into the package.
Oh, the protestware incident.
Right. That code actively wiped files on systems geolocated in Russia and Belarus as a protest against the invasion of Ukraine. It was a massive controversy that really ignited debates about protestware
Yeah.
and the reliability of open source maintainers in general.
But the sources make a very clear distinction here. This new incident is not protestware. And it is not a type of squatting attack where an attacker creates a fake package with a slightly misspelled name, hoping a developer makes a typo during installation.
No, this is the legitimate, highly downloaded NodeIBIC package suddenly exhibiting malicious data theft behavior.
So how did it happen?
Well, the malicious versions were published by a newly created account named AtirTent. And this publication occurred following a 21-month dormant period where the package saw absolutely no updates.
Which is always a red flag.
Oh, huge red flag. This timeline strongly suggests either the original maintainer's credentials were compromised, or a malicious actor social engineered their way into gaining maintainer privileges. Regardless of the method, a trusted component of the software supply chain suddenly woke up and began attacking the developers who relied on it.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The execution method. Typical malicious NPM packages rely on lifecycle hooks, things like pre-install or post-install scripts defined in the package.json file, to trigger their payload when a developer downloads the module.
Right, the standard playbook.
Yeah, and because that's a known tactic, modern software composition analysis tools and CI/CD security scanners actively monitor those hooks.
Yeah.
But this attack completely abandoned that approach.
It's brilliant, honestly. Instead of using lifecycle scripts, the attacker appended an immediately invoked function expression, an IIFE, directly to the core nodeipc.cjs file.
So it just runs automatically.
Yeah, because that JavaScript function is designed to execute the exact millisecond the file is parsed by the runtime environment. So the malware fires unconditionally the moment any code in the developer's project requires the NodeEPIC module.
If you're managing an engineering team right now, you might think your automated pipeline catches malicious packages because you block or strictly monitor suspicious post-install scripts. But this attack bypasses those checks entirely.
Your scanners are looking in the wrong place.
Exactly. The malicious payload is disguised as core application logic. And once it executes, it acts as an absolute credential vacuum. It enumerates the local system and steals 90 different categories of secrets. We are talking AWS, Google Cloud, Azure, SSH keys, Kubernetes tokens, GitHub CLI configs, Terraform states, and even settings for Claude AI and the Kiro IDE.
It just takes everything. And then it compresses all of those stolen credentials into a GZIP archive and exfiltrates them to a domain cleverly named shot.azurestaticprovider.net.
Trying to blend in with legitimate Microsoft Azure telemetry traffic, right?
Exactly. But the execution logic embedded specifically in version 12.0.1 is what truly elevates this operation from a standard data grab to a highly targeted espionage campaign.
Oh, the fingerprint check. Yeah, so the 9.x versions execute and steal data on any machine that downloads them. But version 12.0.1 contains a hard-coded SHA-256 fingerprint check.
Which is terrifying.
It really is. The malware looks at the primary module path of the local machine it is running on, hashes that file directory path, and compares it to a pre-computed hash embedded within obfuscated table fragments in the code.
Right.
A good way to visualize this mechanism is, well, it's like a highly specialized assassin's bullet or a digital combination lock. The lock's tumblers will only align and trigger the payload if the specific server's internal file directory path matches the exact string the attacker pre-calculated. If the hash doesn't match, the malware remains completely dormant.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the implications of that fingerprint check are profound. It means the attacker knew precisely which enterprise project or perhaps which specific developer's workstation they were targeting.
They had prior intelligence.
Exactly. They had prior intelligence on the internal directory structure of their target. For 99.9% of the developers who inadvertently download version 12.0.1, the code remains inert. This is a deliberate anti-analysis technique.
So it hides from researchers.
Yep. It ensures the payload won't trigger in automated security sandboxes or generic threat research environments, allowing the package to remain undetected in the NPM registry for much longer.
And here is where the anti-detection techniques reach another level entirely. Once it steals those credentials, getting a massive GZIP archive out of a secure corporate environment without tripping DNS monitoring is a significant hurdle. Standard corporate firewalls log all DNS requests to identify compromised machines trying to find their command and control servers. So the malware just overrides the system's local DNS resolver.
Yeah, instead of using the corporate DNS to resolve that fake Azure domain, it forces a direct connection to Google public DNS at 1.1.1.1 or 8.8.8.8. It resolves the domain, and then it retargets the resolver directly at the attacker's authoritative name server for all the exfiltration queries.
And it exfiltrates the data using DNS-TXT records. It takes that GZIP archive, Base64 encodes it, chunks it into small pieces, and prepends those chunks of subdomains to the fake Azure domain.
Right.
When the infected machine asks the public DNS to resolve those long, complex subdomains, the DNS protocol inherently delivers the stolen data directly to the attacker within a standard lookup request.
That direct-to-public DNS routing is a critical leap in evasion tactics. By bypassing the local corporate resolvers entirely, traditional DNS logging sees absolutely nothing anomalous.
The queries never touch the internal infrastructure you are monitoring.
Exactly. Furthermore, to ensure the exfiltration completes successfully, the malware forks itself into a detached background child process. So even if the developer realizes the application is behaving strangely and terminates the main Node.js process,
the data theft continues silently in the background. It is a masterclass in infrastructure-aware evasion.
It really is.
So let's distill the practical impacts and the required actions for your environments today. For the Microsoft Exchange XSS vulnerability, you must ensure the EOMT script is applied, particularly for air-gapped systems or those with strict egress rules. And remember, if the status column says applied, ignore the cosmetic invalid for this Exchange version error message.
Trust the status column.
Always. For the Cisco Catalyst SD-WAN 10.0 authentication bypass, you are actively racing against 10 different threat clusters, dropping everything from stealthy web shells to noisy crypto miners. You need to remediate immediately to beat the May 17th federal deadline, but practically, you need to assume your perimeter is being actively scanned right now.
And regarding the NodeEpic supply chain attack, an immediate audit of your NPM publish activity and dependency trees is required. If your development pipelines or production environments touch versions 9.1.6, 9.2.3, or 12.0.1, you must operate under the assumption of a full credential compromise.
Just assume the worst.
Yeah. That necessitates rotating all cloud credentials, SSH keys, Kubernetes tokens, and secrets accessible during that window, as well as conducting a thorough audit of your cloud logs for unauthorized identity and access management actions.
We are seeing a rapid shift in the landscape, moving from manipulating users with emails to exploiting structural flaws in perimeter hardware to injecting DNA-specific malware directly into the open source code we inherently trust. It changes the defensive calculus entirely.
You know, as threat actors refine these operations, dropping targeted infrastructure-aware malware directly into the software supply chain, we have to ask a fundamental question regarding trust. Are we approaching a threshold where relying on third-party code without independently auditing every single line is no longer a viable security posture? And if we reach that point, how does the velocity of modern software development even survive the friction?
Wow. That is the tension every engineering and security team is going to have to navigate moving forward. Because securing the perimeter door doesn't mean much if the building blocks inside are already compromised. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into your daily cybersecurity briefing. We'll be back tomorrow to help you cut through the noise.